tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.
Why should you want to know?
Well, look at that. Another week has veritably flown by. So here we are to try to sift through the news and figure out what it all meant. Welcome to the Weekend Review on KUOW. I'm Luke Burbank, sitting in this week for Bill the Thrill Radke. Trying to get that going as a nickname for him. I'm not getting a lot of traction on that. A couple of things about the program. We're going to be live tweeting it at KUOW, and also we'll be over at the Facebook page at KUOW Public Radio if you would like to interact with us. The kind of news that will be reviewed on this show includes, but is not limited to, Seattle Police Department Chief Kathleen O'Toole, who is making some almost unprecedented shakeups within the department.
You know, I think we've been able to accomplish some good things in recent months, but, you know, we want to bring a greater sense of urgency to it.
And she appears to have. The franchise owners in the Seattle area are unhappy with the $15 minimum wage. They say it's unfair to them. Some of their employees not agreeing.
They're making money hand over fist. If they got enough money to pay for this kind of lawyers, they should have enough to pay the little bit that we've been asking.
And if you think the Seahawks broke your heart with their performance at the end of the Super Bowl, imagine if you'd actually bought tickets to be at the game and then learned you'd been scammed.
My anxiety is at all-time high, and my brother was feeling depressed. We went in there and left because we couldn't deal with the whole uncertainty of not going to the Super Bowl and enjoying these events that were just for the Seahawks fans.
We'll hear one fan's tragic tale. We'll hear all of that with our guests and august panel of Northwest journalist Joni Balter is here from Civic Cocktail and Bloomberg View. Hey, Joni.
Hi. Good morning. August.
Yes.
I'm fixated on it, yeah.
I figured I'd try to start things out on a positive note here by calling you guys august. We've also got the Moss back, Knute Berger, Moss back at Crosscut, also columnist at Seattle Magazine. Hey, Skip.
Hey, Luke.
And an old face I haven't seen in a while. That didn't sound right, Eli. A young
it's
face.
It's a very young face.
A cherubic.
With august.
A cherubic but august young face that I haven't seen for a while. Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger.
Nice to see you again.
Apparently, this is the first time in 35 years that the Seattle Police Department has made the kinds of changes that were announced this week. Kathleen O'Toole introducing four new assistant chiefs, saying that, as you heard in the clip, she wanted to bring a greater sense of urgency to her leadership team. This is the sort of thing that happens in pro sports when you get a new head coach and they fire all of the assistants. Can this make the difference that the Department of Justice has been seeking and that many people in the community say is long overdue in this department?
Well, yeah, actually, is the answer, the simple answer to that. And the short one, I was at City Hall the day that this was announced and ended up talking to, you know, pretty much half the city council, Tom Rasmussen, Sally Clark, Tim Burgess, and they were all, as some folks might say, quelling about all this. Tim Burgess in particular, who led the way on the legislation that changed the rules that allowed you to pick command staff from outside the department, and this was hotly debated. You know, and one thing that he told me was that all the candidates for the new police chief, including Kathleen O'Toole, asked about that in the interview process. So it was a big deal. It's also a good thing, I think, that it's two from outside the department and two from inside the department. So you don't want to diss everyone in the department and say, no way can you move up. We really need to bring in these only Bostonians or someone from Arizona. You know, they're the only ones who can run it. So it was balanced. It was leadership. And it was a good move from what I can tell.
Yeah, because the people who had been occupying those positions, they were allowed to reapply for their jobs and then were later told they had not successfully won back their jobs, right? And that was something that I would have assumed would go over really poorly within the department, and yet the union actually signed off on this.
Yeah, they basically signed off on a trade, which was, can the police department provide more training for officers so that they can advance? In other words, sort of like in the future, we can have a better shot. Or if we decide, officers decide to apply for other departments and that kind of thing, there'd be some kind of trade-off. It just seems like a no-brainer. I mean, I think part of the problem at SPD has been an intractable culture, resistance to change. And, you know, Mayor Murray made it really clear when he was running for office that he wanted an outsider to run the department. But it doesn't do much good if you have to appoint people who might be part of the problem institutionally, and not necessarily that they're bad actors in any way, but that they're used to running things a certain way. And if you're coming through with a mandate from the federal courts to change the way you do everything, you have to have that flexibility. And so I think they've just gained what you used a sports analogy, but I think it's what most people who are brought in to be change agents in an organization, you want to pick your own team. I was really intrigued that they hired a guy from Amazon also to come in. It'll be interesting to see how that goes with the drone program.
Let's talk about this guy for a quick second. His name is Greg Russell. He's a Scotsman. He just became a U.S. citizen last year. And the biggest dazzling detail of this story for me was that he found the job on LinkedIn.
I love that. It's probably the expensive version of LinkedIn.
Right. You think, the premium.
The premium, because that's where they're really specific about who knows who's connected to that job. That hiring is fascinating because it also gets to the notion of, you know, how much this department wants to be data driven. So that whole bit about CSTAT, where does the crime occur and how do we treat it? That's a big thing for this department, and this hiring proves that.
It's also a strange thing for Seattle to have someone jump from Amazon to somewhere else. The trend has always been going in the other direction and everyone coming to the city for jobs at Amazon. So to jump from this really cushy place to the troubled Seattle Police Department.
Well, it may be a commentary on Amazon. And, I mean, I've heard it's competitive.
If you think
moving to the police department to try to stop murders from happening is for you lowering your stress level,
right?
That may speak to the Amazon corporate culture.
And your pay level.
Yeah, he took a pay cut too. This is a little tape of, I would say, he has to have the most mellifluous tones of anybody in the staff.
So my view is, I think we've got a lot of data. We just haven't really figured out how to make it available to people. So I think one of the things I'm going to have to learn is the difference between privacy and transparency, right? And that will be part of that first 30 days, is to learn that.
Those are words to live by.
Well, sorry about that. I was just thinking it always goes down better when they're intruding on your privacy, but they say so with a Scottish accent.
You know, it's like in soccer. You cannot have anybody that doesn't have a British accent calling the games, right? This is going to improve the data.
Yeah.
Descriptions.
Well, the Scottish accent always sweetens everything. I had a Scottish grandmother, so I have a lot of Scottish relatives. And the way he was speaking there is like the Scottish equivalent of Americans speaking so you can understand me.
Uh-huh.
It's all kind of slowed down. And if he were talking among his Scottish mates, it would be incomprehensible.
Eli, the Stranger has often led the charge on talking about police reform. This announcement that these basically the sort of second level of police leadership has now been completely sort of exchanged out. Does that feel like something over at the Stranger? Is that received with good reviews? And also, does it feel like this could really be a sea change for this department?
Yeah, it does. It's something that we've been hoping for a long time. And that rule change that allowed the police department to actually clean the slate of assistant chiefs was obviously huge in enabling this, but it's very big that O'Toole then stepped up and took advantage of this. I think that what we're seeing over and over again from her is, like Joni and Knut were saying, leadership, but also really taking advantage of these opportunities. Ansel Hertz, Stranger news reporter, wrote about the change in chiefs this week. And what he said, I think, is really right, that this is a good move, but the proof essentially is in the pudding. We'll see. They've made changes before and things haven't gone in the right direction. This seems like a change that is really destined to go in the right direction. But again, we will see. There's a lot of effort that still needs to be made to win back the trust of the community, to win back the trust of reporters, to move the department in the right direction. So we'll see.
And will the rank and file serving under these newly installed people, two of them from out of town, will they take the direction from these people or will they resent them, I guess, is a question.
Well, hopefully, if they do resent them, they leave. I mean, what you need at this police department is a culture change. Everyone is saying that. And so if this upsets police officers to the point that they leave, if they're upset about the change, they should be gone. They are the officers that we don't want there. And if you think that's a harsh thing for me to say, consider that the police union president said it to the Stranger recently in another big sea change in tone from the SPD. Ron Smith, the president of the Police Guild, is also an officer. And he told Ansel Hertz, again, who's been following the story very closely, that if people in the department, if people in his union don't like the culture in Seattle, feel like they're being pushed in bad directions by a Justice Department effort simply to get the police department to more represent its community, then they should go. There are other places that they can work. There are more conservative cities if they don't like the politics in Seattle. There are less reformed and respectful police departments that they can go to.
And so, perhaps a more subtle change, but also, and I don't want to get seasick here with these sea changes, but another thing that happened is they pulled a lieutenant, a Leslie Cordner, up to this position.
Which is pretty rare to make a jump, right, of that many spots.
So that sends another message that even if you're number two, number three, you cannot assume that you're still headed upward. That in fact, if somebody shines down below, that they could get that kind of a promotion.
You would imagine that that is an encouraging message to folks to feel like if you're doing a great job, it will be noticed and there's real growth potential for you. All right, coming up in just a moment on The Week in Review. If you're going to scam a fan base, don't scam the fan base that lost in the last 5/10 of a second of the Super Bowl because their attorney general will come after you. That's exactly what Bob Ferguson is doing. We'll explain in a moment. It's A Week in Review on KUOW.
SB Tickets states on its website, quote, "As always, our orders are 100% guaranteed. No tricks or gimmicks. For the unforeseen circumstances, you will get your tickets one way or another, guaranteed." That, as we know, was a lie.
If you were in line for tickets at the Super Bowl and you were using the company SBTickets.com, you may have been in trouble. That's Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson talking about the suit that's been brought against the New York ticket broker, SB Tickets. Basically, there were a huge number of Seahawks fans who bought tickets online from what's called the secondary market. They got down there and they couldn't actually get their tickets. This SB Tickets company had the largest number of complaints, so I guess that's why Bob Ferguson decided to target them. This is KUOW, by the way. We're talking The Week in Review. I'm Luke Burbank, filling in for Bill Radke, joined by Knute Berger, Eli Sanders, and Joni Balter. So the money that Bob Ferguson is, it looks like, trying to recover is about $150,000. And what it is, a lot of these tickets were apparently actually refunded, but the issue is more you got a flight down there, you got a hotel, you spent all this money, and then you ended up watching it in a sports bar like everybody else, and you should get that money back.
What's interesting to me about this, I didn't know that this is how they did the ticket buying on the other end, short sale.
Yeah.
I didn't even understand that when I first read it. I mean, that would be like you going into an ice cream shop and you say you want an ice cream cone and they say, wait right there, and they go in the back and try to find the cow to start milking it.
Or they go to Dairy Queen and try to buy one and bring it back.
But Dairy Queen's charging $10,000 a cone.
Right. We actually talked this week to a guy named Josh Herrera, who was one of these poor, unfortunate souls who bought these tickets and or thought anyway he'd purchased these tickets and headed down to Arizona only to find that he'd been short sailed.
He guaranteed me time and time again, you're going to have a seat. And then I'm like, are you sure? He's like, go to my website. And I went to his website and he had this little thing that said, no matter what, I'll get you a ticket. I'm like, all right, cool. This guy is really going to go to bat for me in case something happens where he can't get the ticket I bought. He'll get me in the stadium.
But when he went to pick up the tickets, it was not as he hoped.
The instruction was to locate the Radisson Hotel in downtown Phoenix to pick up our tickets.
Well, the problem is he went to the Radisson. That's a totally different hotel that's out somewhere in Tucson, I think.
So we had specific instructions. We're like, okay, good. We're not going to go in there and figure out what's the plan. We actually had our day planned around to enjoy the Super Bowl experience. You know, do the whole typical social media thing. Take selfies with the ticket or, you know.
You know, like you would do, Joni, if you were there. Oh. You'd take some selfies with the ticket.
I don't have a selfie stick.
Banned, by the way, in museums. I digress. Back to Herrera.
Take tickets, you know, among the Cardinals fans because it's kind of funny. You know, they're our rivals. But when we woke up and we're starting to find the Radisson had no idea who this guy was. They had no idea what this company was, and so that's an immediate red flag.
It would appear to be this is the problem with the immense popularity of the NFL, right, is that these tickets are going for more and more and more. I read one article shortly after the Super Bowl about a family that spent – they ultimately ended up spending something north of $40,000. They went through the same problem. They found somebody. They paid an inordinate price for these tickets. This game is so popular, the Super Bowl, that the tickets are going to be – super expensive, and there are not going to be enough of them. I guess Bob Ferguson is trying to get some people's money back, but it doesn't seem like it fixes the problem. And by the way, the Seahawks are going to be good again next year, so we're going to be facing the same issue.
What's a better thing to do if you're an elected official than a people's attorney than go to bat for people who are upset that they couldn't get into the Super Bowl? It's like all the politicians who glom onto the Super Bowl win and the Super Bowl hype and make bets and so on, but this is actually one better, like getting some justice for them. I don't understand. I don't follow football very well, so...
Get out.
All right. See you later.
I mean, that is honestly the... tone in this city, right? Maybe not quite that blunt, but it is interesting to me how everyone in the city has now in the last 3-4 years become a Seahawk fan, and there's almost no room to not be a football follower.
Hold on to the bandwagon. I watched the, what do you call it, the game before the Super Bowl,
the NFC Championship game.
Oh, that was the game.
That was our Super Bowl. That's what I'm telling myself.
That's when my season begins. Anyway, that's when I get on the bandwagon. But what I do not understand is why you get on a plane to a city to go to a game that you don't have a ticket in hand for. Is that normal?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm flying to Las Vegas in May to go to the Manny Pacquiao Floyd Mayweather Jr. fight, and there's no way I'm getting a ticket. I'm going to watch it in a sports book, like two doors down from where the fight is. Well, they call it a sports book. That's where you go in and you bet on the horses and all the different.
Oh, I get it.
So actually, there are weirdos like me who would just go to Arizona to just be around the atmosphere of the game. But again, this guy, Josh Herrera, he works at a call center. He went into his savings for this, and he explained that he'd gone to college. He'd lived his whole life in this way, so he would have the resources to do something like go to this game.
Yeah, for a lot of people, this is a once-in-a-lifetime deal, and especially if you're a Seahawks fan. I mean, this is the third time the Seahawks have been to the Super Bowl, but nothing is guaranteed.
You mean like the ending?
Exactly.
You know, I didn't see the end. How did I had to use the restroom. Yeah. What happened?
Did anything happen?
They won, right?
If you missed it, you probably wouldn't have heard about it.
I wish sometimes I could just live in a parallel dimension where I don't know what the ending of that game is. Let me mention, too, that this is a story that we will probably be revisiting next year, or at least there's a good chance. This is because the Seahawks this week signed a guy named Jimmy Graham. For the non-sport obsessed people out there, he's one of the best tight ends in the whole National Football League. And what this means to the Seahawks is that their offense is going to get a lot better. They also re-signed Marshawn Lynch. What this also means is that it's very likely that we will be living in a continued state of Seahawk frenzy. Are we emotionally ready for that? I feel worn out, personally.
Well, just to go to the point about how far this has come, my wife is a psychotherapist. She went to Evergreen. I woke up in the middle of the night not long ago, and she's looking at the highlight reels of a new free agent defensive back, you know, Kerry Williams.
Sure.
And it's like, what is 4 a.m? And you're, you know, and even she's obsessed. It's become a year-round thing. And I think, in a way, I think it's maybe a bonding experience because a lot of women haven't understood. Why do you pay attention to the Seahawks when they're not playing? Well, once you get sort of bonded with a team, you become really fascinated with all the soap opera of who's on the team. She's very upset about Max Unger being traded, but she likes
That was the trade-off to get this guy. I'm just saying, you know, everybody buckle up. The sort of Seahawk craziness is not going anywhere anytime soon.
Well, that seems highly intentional from the way the Seahawks conducted themselves in this trade. I mean, they didn't take anything for granted. They're looking ahead. They're they're more bummed out than we are about what happened there.
No, they're less. I mean, I'd say this in all seriousness because I've been on the field, not at a Super Bowl that ended that way, but I've been on the field many times. And I'll tell you who the least upset people are, the players. Why? They're millionaires. They're all going to Hawaii right after this game.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, really, they understand it's a business. They work at a place. I mean, they certainly want to win. But it's like we, Joe Sixpacks at home, are way more emotionally invested in this, I believe, than they are.
And it sounded like Marshawn Lynch used the lack of giving him the ball for that final play as leverage to get more money in his negotiation.
Well, it worked. He's going to make an additional $4 million. You know who's not making $4 million? People who are working for $15, or hopefully someday $15 an hour at your various food franchises around town. We'll talk about that coming up in just a moment, right here on Week in Review.
Mm-hmm.
right, welcome back to KUOW's Week in Review. Luke Burbank sitting in the hot seat for Bill Radke this week, joined by Eli Sanders from The Stranger, Knut Berger from Crosscut, and Joni Balter from Civic Cocktail. Representatives of the franchise owners of Seattle and King County were in court this week trying to block part of the $15 an hour minimum wage because they say that it treats them unfairly as large businesses. Here's a report from KUOW's Deb Wong.
The interesting thing about franchises is that some people have really strong opinions about them, both pro and con. So let's start with the pro side.
Hi, how are you? Welcome to Subway.
Joseph Chang is a big booster of franchises. He owns two, both Subway sandwich shops on Seattle's First Hill.
What type of sandwich can we make you? Turkey sandwich? Okay, sure.
On this day, he's donned plastic gloves and is helping serve the lunch crowd.
All right. Enjoy your lunch. Thank you. Thank
you. I do from A to Z. I'm the hands-on owner. I do making sandwiches. I do wash the floors. I fix my plumbing.
Chang says franchises were the perfect way for him to get his start in business. He immigrated to the U.S. from Taiwan in 1981. He was young, didn't speak English, and knew very little about owning a business.
I think franchise program is still very important, very valuable. The franchise program teaches you a real world. The school only tells you, say, okay, this is how you do it. But the franchise program, they hold your hand to do it. And that's day and night different.
And that's a story you hear from people who own franchises. The business is yours, but the corporation provides the products, advertising, and business expertise. So those are the pros. Now, what about the cons?
What do we want?
15!
What do we want?
Now!
This is sound from a minimum wage protest last year. The movement for a $15 an hour minimum wage targeted fast food franchises like McDonald's and KFC. Sejal Parikh is from the group Working Washington.
So we know that when McDonald's at the national level is making corporate profits that are astonishingly high and workers are struggling to make ends meet, we know that there is money out there for workers to be able to be paid a fair wage.
And labor activists went after franchises in particular because they say the model doesn't work.
Well, the franchise business model was developed beginning in the 1950s specifically as a way of forcing workers to live in poverty.
David Rolfe is the head of the Service Employees International Union Local 775, which was heavily involved in organizing the fast food strikes. He says the franchise system is designed to allow large corporations to absolve themselves of any responsibility for employees.
Are the employees of these giant multinationals really employees of small local businesses, or is this just a strategy that was invented by smart lawyers in the New York and other global headquarters of these companies to force risk onto the least powerful people in the whole economic equation, the workers, and then their immediate bosses, who are the operators of the local stores.
So those are the two views of franchises in a nutshell, the pro and the con.
Excellently laid out by KUOW's Deb Wong. Do the franchisees have a point, Joni Balter?
Well, here's what I think. I think this is a very close call in a funny way, because some of these franchises are really sort of these small businesses, immigrants, just like, you know, Deb's report. But on the other side, and I interviewed the mayor and the city attorney on this topic in different ways. One I just bumped into, that was the city attorney. But the gist of it is, if you think about it on the other side, a franchise benefits from quite a lot by being a franchise. I'm going to McDonald's or, you know, the Holiday Inn because I know the name. They get, you know, economies of scale and purchasing what they sell, and a lot of benefit from being part of the franchise. So that's why I think it is kind of a reasonable question to ask. Now, the city attorney told me Thursday that he didn't think the injunction would happen next week. And I don't know if this is bravado or if this is really just the way he sees the case laying out. It's close.
Well, they made the division based on how big your company is.
Yeah, it's like 500 employees is the cutoff. So if you have a Subway sandwich shop with four employees, you have in their eyes, 500-plus employees, because Subway nationally has that many employees.
And I think that gets to Joni's point about the economies of scale. As the franchisee was laying out there, the advertising, they're deriving huge benefit from these large corporations so that the staffing level looks sort of artificially small compared to the actual clout that the company represents. The other thing to remember, too, is a lot of these franchise owners, even of small franchises, make a ton of money. There are a lot of very wealthy people who owned a McDonald's franchise. You know, they may get in there and roll their sleeves up and do, you know, some of that work themselves, but many of them, it's a very lucrative business.
And you do see the difference in clout and resources in the courtroom. I believe the franchise owners brought in a former Solicitor General of the United States to argue against our city attorney, and nothing against our city attorney, who's a very fine man, but he's not the Solicitor General of the United States. They have deep pockets to fight this with, while at the same time trying to claim that the people in their franchise structure at the bottom are just impoverished or scraping by small business people.
Bond Huberman, who is our social media producer, what are people saying about this?
Hi. So we got a lot of feedback on this story. Eric points out fast food corporations use their franchises as human shields by design. That's how they extract profit.
A KUOW listener, not a fan of McDonald's. I'm glad I'm sitting down. Anything else?
Ian offered an interesting point. Somebody made the comment that, you know, an increase to $15 for an entry-level position is ludicrous, and Ian responded to that saying, try working at a McDonald's, buddy. I had doctors, lawyers, and military officers working for me. They could hardly cut it. It's not easy work. Multitasking is actually really hard, and very few are good at it.
That is the irony of these, thank you, Bond, these jobs that we see as these kind of entry-level jobs or low-wage jobs. I used to work at Dick's Drive-In when I was in high school, and it was hands down the hardest job I've had in my adult life to this point. I got into radio because I couldn't cut it making food all day and standing up. I mean, these are really difficult jobs in a lot of cases.
But why couldn't you put lettuce and tomato on the...
Joni, there's a system, and it is called No Substitutions, as Dick Spady intended it. And believe me, I once had a member of the Husky basketball team try to come through the glass because I wanted to charge 5 cents for the tartar,
which
I was trying to explain from a sort of, you know, like a libertarian standpoint to him. I said, the good news is you don't have to pay for condiments you're not going to use at other places. See how I'm tying this all in? At places like McDonald's, you're paying for the ketchup whether or not you use it. We only charge you for the condiments that you actually want to use. He was not hearing that and cracked the window of the Lake City Dicks with his shoulder.
Those are thick.
Yeah, we had to close down the next day. So you listen to the story that was laid out in Deb's piece. You hear this great tale of somebody who has rolled up their sleeves and really has lived the American dream. And yet, I do feel like he has a point in that they're paying a lot of money to be part of this franchise. And Knut, to your point, certainly people have made, they've been profitable, they've made a good living with this. To me, it's not the same as if Subway had a sandwich shop, but it was run by the mothership. That, to me, is a big company. A person who's got 4 employees and has to send, I don't know, whatever percentage of the profits every month back to the home office, that feels to me more like a small business person.
And that's why I think it is the close call. And I love the phrase in Deb's web story that talked about this is the American dream with guardrails. That's a great phrase for what it is for them. You know, it really is a close call, and folks have to figure out which category, you know. The franchises are going to raise their salaries to $15. It's just a question of when.
Well, that's the other thing, right? I mean, it's not a question of pay anything you want versus pay $15 an hour. It's a matter of at what point these various standards are met, right?
Right. How quickly the phase-in happens. And the idea was that the franchises could afford a quicker phase-in. And what they're saying is it's unconstitutional to treat us unfairly relative to smaller businesses, which were given a break.
Right, but I mean, we talk about these things, and again, I'm not trying to minimize the impact on the small businesses, but these things get talked about as if it's the difference between $15 an hour and $0 an hour, and it's the difference between an additional dollar per hour some month or year before you really want to start paying that. You know what I mean? It's like, it seems like it's happening one way or the other. Another standard of living story that moved through the Northwest Transom this week is the fact that it would appear that the middle class here in King County is at a complete standstill. Let's see if I can grab the stat here. This is from a piece Gene Balk wrote in the Seattle Times. This is the headline. Since 2000, 95% of new households in King County have been either rich or poor.
Yeah, well, it's really shocking. I mean, the numbers, 80,000 households have been added in the last 15 years. Of those, basically 40,000 of those households, people are making, as a household, half of the median income, so 35,000 or less. The other 40% are making nearly double the median, $125,000 or more. So the interesting thing is that the middle class, those people making between $35,000 and $125,000, there's no growth there. That is not a growing sector of the economy. And that is a really stark change from what Seattle and surrounding areas have been, which is fairly small number of poor people, fairly limited number of rich people, large group in the middle. And that's really starting to shift. Seattle Times reported, I think, late last year, some other numbers that I found even more shocking, which was the black middle class in Seattle has virtually vanished.
Incomes are going down for African Americans.
Incomes are plummeting. I mean, not just going down, but plummeting. So the median household income in Seattle is about $70,000. Median for African American family, $26,000. And that's down from the year 2000, when the adjusted, if you adjusted in 2013 dollars, the household income for African American families was the equivalent of about $44,000. So there's been a huge plummet in the African American community. And nobody really knows what all the reasons are. You can sort of say, well, we're sort of service jobs and Amazon jobs.
Well, Dow Constantine said, I believe, what was the quote? He said it was people doing really well and people making espresso for people who are doing really well.
The latte makers and the latte drinkers, right?
Exactly why the 15 fight has such resonance. I mean, when you're talking about these things getting boiled down to really emotional, simple fights, it's because of this disparity that people are seeing.
Well, sort of old Seattle, new Seattle. In old Seattle, something that people really loved about Seattle was police officers, firefighters could live in, say, a bungalow in the city and have a fishing cabin on Hood Canal or something like that. You know, this is sort of the new world here. You know, when folks look at you and say, well, eventually you'll be just like San Francisco, not sure that's a compliment.
I remember it from years ago. I was renting in the Hawthorne Hills neighborhood, which is kind of over Bryant and Laurelhurst, kind of by Children's Hospital. And I was talking to an elderly neighbor, and she was explaining to me who used to live in this neighborhood. And it was like, oh, that was Bill. He was a butcher, and that, you know, guy was a postman. And I was thinking, like, unless I hit the lottery, I could never buy a house in this neighborhood. And it used to just be the normal people that were living in Seattle.
There's interesting history there, too. And I just to say that there was kind of a deal that was made, you know, back in the 30s and 40s with the unions. And in exchange for getting rid of labor unrest, the wages of the union workers went up so that working class people could be in the middle class. And that's why you had a lot of people owning their own bungalows, their own houses. Could work at a manufacturing job at Boeing, put your kids through college, and maybe have a little summer place on Hood Canal. It was a very different kind of economy. And the decline of union workers, the decline of workers in the public sector, as well as some of these other kind of macroeconomic changes that are going on are really changing, fundamentally changing Seattle's, what was our kind of 20th century identity.
And the new jobs are many, many of the new jobs, certainly not all of them, are in the tech sector, and that's high paying. So that's changing the distribution of this.
All right, we need to take a quick break here. When we come back, though, we know that you love your kids, and we know you're just trying to give them a good feeling. So maybe someday they can be one of those high-tech earners, but you may be messing them up with the way you're complimenting them. We'll talk about the next generation of narcissists in a moment on the Week in Review on KUOW. Welcome back to the Week in Review here on KUOW. I'm Luke Burbank, sitting in for Bill the Chill Radke, as he's been now named by Joni Balter. Joni's here. Also, we have Knute Berger and Eli Sanders. We've got our social media producer, Bond Huberman, here as well, who's live tweeting the show over at KUOW, or you can always check in at the Facebook page, which is KUOW Public Radio. Interesting bit of news came by way of NPR this week. It was a study conducted by a professor at Ohio State University. Now, if you were to tell your young daughter she is very smart, or that she's a very special kid, or that she got good grades because she worked really hard, according to this research, one of those is probably going to ruin her life.
The best thing to tell her is that she worked hard.
Absolutely, Joni.
That's what it said on that.
That's right. Story. That's the compliment that you should be using. You should not be telling her, again, according to this research, that she is a very special kid. What they found when they analyzed a bunch of different kids was that the more narcissistic children in this particular study had parents who consistently overvalued their accomplishments.
Well, this generation has been accused, and I'm going to stay neutral on this, of being pretty pampered, pretty spoiled. Everybody gets a trophy.
Mm-hmm.
And so that maybe is what inspired that study. You know, parents tell their kids all three of those, like, pretty much all day, right?
Yeah, but I mean, Eli?
This seems like blowback from the self-esteem movement. People, well-meaning people, trying to give their kids good self-esteem, which was the last thing that I think you were supposed to do, according to studies,
right,
told their kids that they were great all the time, even when they weren't great, creating these kind of praise junkies and narcissists. And so now the new thing is don't overpraise. But
maybe praise accurately.
Right.
Like, hey, you worked hard studying for that, not you're an incredible human who managed to. I mean, you have kids. What do you make of this?
I mean, I think telling your kids they're wonderful and all that is a good thing. But the whole specialness deal, what really epitomized that for me was Harry Potter. I mean, it's just like you watch the Harry Potter movie and it's just everything is he's a special person. He's special. He's special. Oh, he's special. Day, did we tell you Harry Potter's very special? The kids are identifying. I mean, I grew up, we watched Lassie. It was the dog that was special.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
It wasn't the kid.
The kid was always falling down a well.
Yeah, exactly.
Timmy, get always, it together, dude.
Yeah, exactly. So I do think there's been a kind of, you know, weird shift of people kind of counting on specialness. But I think, you know, if your kids have particular attributes that you want to cultivate, creativity, artistic sense, mathematics or whatever, you can do that in a way that doesn't turn them into, you know, flaming narcissists.
Well, I mean, one of the points that this study found was, at least in this one particular case, it didn't appear to be the result of parents withholding approval, which I think for a long time was the thought that you became a narcissist because you never got the attention that you sought as a kid. So now you're sort of overcompensating. That, again, according to this one study, is maybe not what's creating this.
I'm stuck back on the praise junkie thing. And
that sounds like an electro band that will be playing at the Capitol Hill Block Party this year.
Of course it is.
Stuck on the praise junkie?
Yeah.
I'm stuck on the praise junkie. But also what you said, you should praise accurately. So if you have a kid who does something well, praise accurately. I had two kids who could write pretty well, noticed in the school. So you nurture that because you want them to have something that they can be proud of. And so, you know, maybe it goes into sports too. You swim well. And to my daughter, you pitch very poorly. You lost the game. You know, that kind of thing. So, but yeah, I think you should be accurate. I think you nailed it.
I'm not proud to admit this on public radio, but I watch the show Intervention a lot. And there's a very sort of regular narrative arc that this show always follows. It's following somebody who's had problems with drugs or alcohol. And there's always the beginning where the parents are describing the kid. And the parents will always say, he was the smartest kid you'd ever met. One parent said the other week, he had a genius IQ. And I thought, I'd like to see the data on that. Or one said, she was the funniest person I'd ever met. And I thought, no, the funniest person you ever met was probably Will Ferrell or something. It was not your kid who is a junkie. And I can't help but feel that, like, these parents who were saying these kids were the greatest kids of all time, there's no way that was equipping them well for future life. Speaking of kids, by the way, the youth and the drugs, Seattle City's attorney's office is trying to spread the message through 9 billboards that young people should be above the influence of drugs, in particular marijuana. We are now over 2 years into the legalization of marijuana in this state, and the concern is that kids are taking marijuana really lightly. There was this also a survey that went on that the 200,000 students between grades 6, 8, 10, and 12, they were asked about their health and their behaviors, and a huge percentage of them said that marijuana was not harmful and it was easy to get.
Yeah, well, so when we legalized, we in Colorado 2 years ago legalized marijuana, that was, you know, a big concern. And there were supposed to be, and now there are programs trying to, in other words, say that just by legalizing it, we weren't saying it was good for kids. Because marijuana, many, many studies show, is not good for people who are under 21. It's not. But there are studies all over the place. I looked up the Colorado studies today, and they say both things. Because Colorado's had its stores open since last January. Ours, the very few that we have only been open since July. So we don't really have a year to collect the data and tell you what really is cooking here. But the gist of it is, use is about even. The thing that the experts, this guy Mark Kleiman out of UCLA, wants to know is sort of regular users. Your study was getting at, can you get it? Have you tried it? Type mm-hmm. stuff. But the concern is about people who take the cue of legalization and then become regular users. That's the concern, I think.
And when we pass this legalization bill, part of the law that we voted for says a certain amount of the tax revenue goes to education about
right.
pot and its effects. And then another part of it, more interestingly, I think, goes to research about its effects. There's a lot that we still don't know, and where the age cutoff is that you should be using less or more, and exactly how much is too much at what age. And one of the interesting things in these stories about this is that while we've been talking about all the state revenue that's coming in from the pot stores, the state's not yet actually farmed out the money to do these public education campaigns.
Right. They've been sort of scraping the money together. Here's one of these PSAs that's aimed at helping educate the young people.
Part of the tax revenue collected from recreational pot is supposed to go to education of marijuana laws, but
the legislature can change the spending requirements.
It's actually a story from Como TV, by the way, just so you know what you're hearing.
I hope that they won't.
Since I-502 has passed the two-year mark, the state legislature can now make any changes it wants, including using funds earmarked for education to go to something else.
It's certainly not yielding the educational programs that I-502 envisioned.
Some say adults need a billboard campaign aimed at them.
By the way, that was Pete Holmes, the city attorney. I mean, that is a question, too, is like this above the influence campaign that, like I said, it's 9 billboards, okay, around Seattle. And they are encouraging kids to take selfies showing what inspires them to not use drugs and alcohol. And I guess if their selfie is deemed the best selfie, and really, how do you judge? I mean, the selfies are like snowflakes. Each one is different and beautiful in its own way. But the winners... You're
creating a generation of narcissists.
Yeah, exactly. Your selfie skills are unbelievable, Finn. The prizes include Seattle Seahawks and Sounders tickets. So they're trying to incentivize...
Hope they're the good tickets, not
right,
the bad
right, not the scam ones. I guess my question is, like, if the money does start to flow and if we do now have the funding to create these PSAs, does it seem possible that this could actually influence behavior in young people who I do think... If there is a group that shouldn't be overdoing it on the ganja, it's people whose brain is still developing.
Correct.
You know, we've had these anti-drug campaigns before that Nancy Reagan just say mm-hmm. no, the egg frying in the frying pan.
Yeah. I still think of that every time I make breakfast, by the way. It has no impact on my drug use, but it's vivid when I'm just trying to have a fried egg.
You know, and I just don't think those things are generally successful. I mean, they're going to have to come up with some sort of guerrilla campaign that makes not using pot seem like Joe Camel or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, in other words, you know, doing PSAs and that kind of thing. Maybe bribing kids with tickets, Seahawks tickets. Maybe that is not such a bad idea. But, you know, I just can't imagine that teenagers have, you know, would be influenced by some billboard.
But they're influenced by a culture change, if you think about it. So the drunk driving, the tobacco, over time, these campaigns actually do work. You know, the problem here in Washington is our pot stores opened in July. There weren't very many of them. They're not generating the revenue that was originally envisioned in the 502 campaign, but eventually they might. And that should slough off enough money for some of the education that could lead to a culture change.
And what would really help the education campaigns would be to have more research also from that tax money so that you can have something kind of equivalent to the Surgeon General's warning on cigarette packets. I know that doesn't stop teenagers from smoking, period, but it actually gives them a real thing to push off against and evaluate the risk relative to, rather than just, you know, a selfie that someone made saying
they're above the influence.
Right.
Right. Well, also reinforcing the idea that there is an age limit, because I think the poll showed
right.
that a significant number of adults have no idea that 21 was the age. And I don't think people have paid attention, a lot of attention to.
Yeah, it just kind of seemed like, well, I guess we can all do that now.
Right.
To a lot of people.
I think everybody knows about the drinking laws at 21. So maybe educating the adults is the first step.
There has been some controversy this week surrounding the Port of Seattle's decision to allow Shell Oil to use Terminal 5 as a place to keep exploration vessels. There was a meeting this week, and it would appear that the move will continue to go forward, if I read this right. The environmentalists who showed up were basically of the opinion that allowing Shell to kind of park its vessels here is ultimately aiding and abetting the destruction of the environment. The other side of it was, hey, it's jobs.
As it always is in these kinds of debates. But, you know, just classic Seattle, and this is important in this case, this was a little bit about process, as in there wasn't enough. Where right. was that process? Didn't notice it, because this came up, and The Stranger did a heck of a job on this story, I thought, explaining how this sort of came down. It was kept under the radar for quite some time, and then it came to a public meeting, and guess what? Not that many people cover port meetings anymore, which is not a good thing, because this is how this occurs. And only one or two, maybe, of the port commissioners, depending on how you gauge what was said and who voted what way and offered motions, really said, let's open it up and see what the public has to say about this.
So right now, there's a hearing on a lawsuit that's been filed to try to reverse this. And like you said, hundreds of people, or close to 200 people, came to this port meeting, which is like highest attendance at a port meeting ever.
That same ticket company was scalping seats.
Yeah. And you should see what happens when you don't give someone their port meeting ticket.
That's right. It gets ugly.
Plus the hotel. Go
right.
ahead.
And there's a Radisson at the airport.
Yep. Totally. That's a great callback. Right. Whoever's listening to the podcast version will get that joke, because they've been present for the entire 60 minutes.
Basically, to come back to the point here, Seattle is about to host the apparatus of planetary destruction in the form of Shell's Arctic drilling rigs. This was pushed through in a process that even the port now admits was flawed, because they offered a motion at this meeting to, in the future, have better process. But that doesn't change the outcome that was already pushed through. And people are now fighting in whatever way they can to say Seattle is not the place to have Arctic drilling rigs. We don't support this.
Yeah, we've got to wrap things up here. I will say, though, in related maritime news, the Kalakala, what's left of it, is on display in Parkland right now. I am driving down there after the show to see if I can find something. This is not a joke. I'm that excited about it. I'm not sure if the parts of the Kalakala will somehow re-congeal back into the boat. I feel this boat is somehow still indestructible, even though it's been torn into pieces. So I'll report back on how that goes. Thank you so much, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter, and Knut Berger. Thanks, Bond Huberman, too, for helping out. Jason Pagano producing things, and Bernard Wallet on the ones and twos. Have a great Friday. We'll be back next week.